Notes from the LEFF Forum 2017, Part 1. The conference titled Resistance was held in New York City June 2nd through June 4th, and it looked at questions of power, strategy, and tactics as the resistance to Donald Trump rises. The focus of many panels this year was on moving beyond Trump into an examination of the system which produced him. Part 1 of Notes from the LEFF Forum is drawn from a panel called Reality Check. Why now, more than ever, it's time for radical resistance and a green-left collaboration to move it forward. With Chris Hedges, Medea Benjamin, Dr. Jill Stein, and Margaret Kimberlin.
Frankly, if we don't change this system as a species, we're not going to be here.
Chris Hedges, author, teacher, critic, former foreign correspondent for nearly two decades. He writes for Truth Dig. His most recent book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. He lays out where we are politically. He says Trump is the symptom, not the disease, that for the last 30 years we've had a corporate kleptocracy, a rule by thieves, beginning with what he says is damage from Bill Clinton, and that now we are in a state of deep paralysis.
We're in a state of stasis, there's no movement. And the deep state has crippled even Trump. I have obviously find Trump as repugnant. I mean, he's like something coughed up out of the Grand Guignol. But he the whole kind of framing of this as that he's a stooge of Russia, or that Russia was the one that spun the elections, is an absurdity when you think about it, when you parse it. And let me throw in for, because I did hear this kind of talk at the LEFF Forum in the past, it is as absurd as the idea that Ralph Nader elected George W. Bush. So look at what they're saying. And of course, it's just the media is just bombarding you from the repugnant Rachel Maddow on down. The idea that I guess tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of Hillary Clinton supporters woke up one morning and read the John Podesta emails and said, "That's it. I'm voting for Donald Trump." That's kind of what they're telling you. Or if you read the 7 pages in the Director of National Intelligence report dedicated to RT America, where I have a show, and the power of RT America, which, let's be frank, no one watches, convinced massive numbers of Americans to vote for the Green Party. That's really it. And it is as demagogic as what Trump is doing towards Muslims, but it's demagoguery from the liberal elites. And it doesn't face the fundamental reality. The reason the Democratic Party got shellacked, and not just in the presidential election, is because they betrayed working men and women. They thrust a knife into the back of the working class. And, you know, if I hear one more time about the Clintons being a friend of African Americans, I teach in a prison, and I can tell you 80% of my students wouldn't be there but for Bill and Hillary Clinton. No, I'm not joking. Seriously, the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, what did it do? It exploded the prison population. I was up visiting Mumia Abu-Jamal, our great revolutionary, one of the most courageous figures in America, and one of our most important intellectuals. And he was looking around the room going, you know, none of these people would be here but for the Clintons. And that selling out came with an ideological, a use of traditional liberal terms that became inverted. So for instance, what did a post-racial America become? It became about a black president who was Cornel West served as a black mascot for Wall Street. What does feminism become? I mean, I come out of Andrea Dworkin, who is a feminist for me, and a real one, and Dworkin said that feminism is about empowering oppressed women. It is not about a woman CEO or a woman president. And what's happened, and this I just finished teaching a semester at Princeton. What's happened in the universities and in the liberal elites, if they have totally bought this mantra that we will color code elitist institutions, meanwhile, poor people of color and the working class and will be thrown under the bus. And that's precisely what's happened. I just want to end by talking a little bit about the white working class, which has aligned behind Trump, which is angry, racist, xenophobic. All of these things are true. However, the pain of the white working class is real, and it's legitimate. And we are going to have to begin to build bridges to people who think differently than us and perhaps even say things that we disagree with. I come from rural Maine, and I can assure you many of my relatives, who I love very much, there were things that came out of their mouth that were highly inappropriate. They were poor, lower-class workers. And my rule was, you can say whatever you want when you go home, but you can't say that in front of me. But I still love you, and I care about you. And we have to, and I think Nader has been pushing this, and Nader is right, we have to begin to organize, and we're going to have to build, we're going to have to align ourselves or build movements, because at this point, I think it's good that we, you know, run a Green Party candidate. I'm all for it, but I think at this point it is, I gave a talk on Gramsci last night, it is kind of like Gramsci trying to organize the Communist Party under Mussolini's fascism. They put so many roadblocks in that it's, Trotsky actually writes a lament for Gramsci for trying to do this. And I think that we're going to have to begin to find our strength by building a consensus around issues that people care about within their communities that are in many ways seen as apolitical but are not apolitical. That is raising the minimum wage. That is blocking fracking from destroying your water system. That is stopping Betsy DeVos from destroying your public school. And it is going to come through acts of mass civil disobedience. And there's Ralph Pointer, who's led the life we should all lead, doing it. I don't think you ever got arrested for resisting arrest. I think you got arrested for assaulting police officers. Am I right about that, Ralph? Not the same thing. Don't believe that. That guy was a boxer in Pittsburgh. So, but I think that's it. They're going to get nasty and they're going to get rough because the Democratic Party is not going to change. They are wedded. Schumer as an alternative. The bag man for Wall Street for the Democratic Party, and we saw with the 200 protesters at the inauguration, they are going to come down. We saw it with the brave water resistors and water defenders in Standing Rock. It's going to be dirty and it's going to be ugly, but it's the fight of our lives because, frankly, if we don't change this system as a species, we're not going to be here. Thank you.
Author and critic Chris Hedges. You're listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 1, speakers from the Reality Check panel looking at a green-left collaboration moving forward. Next up, Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, also co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. She says it's disheartening to see how hard the Democrats work to prop up the empire. Medea Benjamin's newest book is Saudi Arabia, Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection.
I wrote this book recently on Saudi Arabia because, you know why I did it actually? Because every year I would go out to AIPAC, the Israel lobby, and we would be out there fighting with these people going into AIPAC, literally getting beaten up every single year by the people going into AIPAC, and the police would never protect us. I'm Jewish, so other, you know, Jewish people going into AIPAC would say, why don't you do something about those Arab regimes? Why are you always picking on Israel? So I thought, all right, maybe there's some truth to that, you know? and I started researching and doing work around Saudi Arabia. And it was amazing to me to find that not only has the U.S. since the 1930s, the time that the Saudi Empire was created, been supporting this regime, but it was really under Obama that they became the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. Under Obama, 42 separate weapons deals under Obama. Did the Republicans say, oh, why are we giving to this horrible, you know, Arab Wahhabist, intolerant, misogynist regime that's spreading terrorism around the world? No, they were all for weapons sales. Did the progressive Democrats stand up and say, why are we giving to this misogynist, intolerant, blah, blah, blah? Not at all. And so you saw both parties doing the most unthinkable thing if you really want national security for the United States, which is supporting the very country that was spreading extremist ideology that forms the foundation of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And so even today when Trump goes to Saudi Arabia and all of a sudden some Democrats are saying, ooh, what's he doing selling all these weapons to the Saudis? The majority of them in Congress, you know, they have the right 30 days after weapons deal is announced to stand up and say no to that deal. You know how hard it is for us to get even the majority of the progressive caucus in Congress to say no to weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, because not only is it supporting this repressive regime internally, but because they're using the weapons to decimate the people of Yemen. Absolute catastrophe what's going on in Yemen. And we can't even get the majority of progressive Democrats to say no. Now that is shameful. That is absolutely unacceptable. And I want to give another example, and I see my comrade here, Arielle Gold from Code Pink, who does our Israel-Palestine work, because she is braving going into Congress to try to get them to do the simplest thing that you can imagine. You know, there's the whole thing, progressive and everything but Palestine. Well, you know, it's... You can't find people in Congress who are good on Palestine. And she had to work from May until, from October of last year until May, to get one person in Congress to stand up and say they would initiate a letter. It's just a letter, it's not even a bill, saying that the Gandhi of Palestine, Issa Amro, known as the Gandhi of Palestine because he is supportive and definitive about using nonviolent tactics. He has been given awards around the world. He's recognized by the European Union. He's brought here actually by the State Department. He is facing 18 charges. In a military court that has over 99% conviction rate. And we are trying to get somebody in Congress to stand up and say to Tillerson, maybe the Israelis should reconsider this. That's what they're asking for. It took months to get somebody to do it. And our goal is to get 25 members of Congress. 25. You know how many members of Congress we have, right? 435. We want to get just 25 to sign on to this letter. And that will be an incredible victory if we get those 25. That's how pathetic it is. That's how horrible it is. That's how awful these Democrats are. And so, of course, we need a new party. Of course we need a new party. Now, the question and the discussion, I think, is what is that party? Is it the Green Party? And we certainly have a fabulous representative of the Green Party right here in Jill Stein. Is it another party, a new party? Is it a coalition of parties? I don't know. I think it's an important discussion to have. But when I look at Europe and I look at other places around the world, I see new parties coming in with fresh ideas and sweeping the public imagination. And I think maybe it is a new party that we need. I don't know. I just say that we need something outside the two-party system, and that is for sure. What do we do in the meantime? We support the parties, the independent, the non-mainstream parties that do exist. What else do? We create more coalitions of coalitions. We create more networks that we can have both people involved in independent party politics and people who are the activists on the street. Those kind of coalitions have to form. I might be a minority in this room, but I also think we have to work with people who call themselves and consider themselves progressive Democrats, because I think a lot of those people have many of the same values that we do, and we do need to work with them. I also think, see, there's some of us in the room. Didn't get a thunderous applause there, but I got a couple. I also think that when Chris said about civil disobedience, we are not doing enough to show our opposition. I love marches. I go to marches all the time. I say a protest today keeps the doctor away. I'm always going to protest. But let me tell you, walking around on a Saturday and a Sunday in a circle, coming back to the same place you started when everything else is closed, that's really not like super impactful. So I would much rather see 100 people going into Congress and doing a sit-in in the lobby of the Hart Building and taping over that building. So raise your hand if you have done civil disobedience for justice here in this room. So that should be everybody. And I would say now under Trump, it has to be all of us in this room and a whole lot more. A couple of final points I want to make. One is that our wins are going to be on the local level, but we have so much, not only has the right taken over the White House and the Congress, but look at two-thirds of the governorships, look at two-thirds of the legislatures, look at so many of the courts on the local level. Where are we? We have not done nearly enough. We can name a couple of cities. We can name some, you know, successes that we have at the local level, but we have to do much, much more at electing progressives at the local level, at doing good coalition building at the local level, at forcing city councils to pass resolutions from $15 an hour to sanctuary cities to say hell no to another $54 billion for the Pentagon, whatever, those kinds of things. We have to have more and more of those that we're forcing our city councils and our mayors to do. And I think also we have to, while we are taking down this system, we have to be building up the alternatives. And I'm so glad that there are so many sessions here at the Left Forum that talk about everything from worker co-ops to credit unions to public banks and all of the pieces that we're creating of a new economy. But there is also the way that we live. I always thought that living in a nuclear family was kind of a silly way to live. But we have not created enough alternatives where we really have different lifestyles that are so appealing for people that no matter what their ideology is, they want to come and be in our alternative lifestyles. And it is beautiful to see out of so much of the problems in places like Detroit, those kinds of things popping up with beautiful urban gardens, with communities coming together. I'm spending more time in Miami right now because we're part of a community that's taken over a whole block in Little Haiti and is refusing gentrification and has turned it into a farm. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place to be and feel part of community. So we need these kind of things to keep us together, what we at Cold Pink call the local peace economy. And finally, what I want to say is that it sometimes gets very hard working in the left because it feels sometimes like a circular firing squad. And we are constantly backbiting each other. We are constantly saying that somebody is not politically correct enough or doesn't do this enough or whatever it is. You know what we need in our movement? We need a lot more kindness. We need a lot more gentleness. We need to be a lot more loving with each other, tolerant of each other. Chris said that he has relatives who are Trump supporters. I have lots of relatives who are Trump supporters. Every time I come to New York and stay with them, it's Trump supporters. I love them as well, and I work with them and I talk to them. But within even our non-Trump supporters, our community, we have to be much, much, much kinder to each other. So those are my final words. It's with love and with kindness that we will build a much stronger movement. Thank you.
Code Pink's Medea Benjamin. Next up, Dr. Jill Stein, 2016 Green Party presidential candidate, physician, and environmental activist.
In my view, Donald Trump is not the one to be afraid of, nor is Rachel Maddow and MSNBC, or Hillary Clinton for that matter. What we have to be afraid of is not standing up and taking our destiny back into our own hands, because we are the only ones who will save us. And I think in the same way you can say kindly and gently to a friend who is trapped in an abusive personal relationship that we got a problem here with the Democratic Party. And that this faith in the Democratic Party, the defense of the Democratic Party, is really contrary to a reality check. And that was what we had in mind when we talked, at least what I had in mind, when we thought about calling this a reality check. A reality check about where do we stand in terms of our survival, in terms of fascism, the hope that democracy will survive, that our planet will survive, that our economy will survive, that racial justice will somehow, you know, be resurrected out of our prison system, and out of our drug wars, and out of the battered economies of the African American communities, not just in this country, but all around the world. You know, we've got a critical problem here. And we're not gonna get out of here by running through the same paces. And for those who continue to put their hope and faith in the Democratic Party, I think, you know, in the same way, if you had a friend in an abusive relationship and their life is at risk, it's really important. You owe it to them to at least have a gentle discussion. And, you know, you can't take people where they're not going to go, but you do owe them an honest discussion and just an honest sharing. And I think any accounting of the facts here is that we can't keep doing what we've been doing. And I think that means, you know, that doesn't make it easy. It's not easy to develop a new political party. And let me say that, you know, the Green Party I see as sort of the foundation because it is a national party. If you have not been involved in establishing a new national party, then you have a very rude awakening about what it is like to establish a new political party in the context of 21st century America. Everything is tilted against you. It is not easy, but we do have a very hard-won foundation, which is open. It's open for joining, for discussion, even for, you know, a new name, if we had to entertain. I mean, I find so often this boils down to the name, because our agendas have actually converged. And this has been really clear over the last, I'd say, 5 years, that our agendas have come together. We've been working together with the other socialist, progressive, peace and freedom parties. And it's hard to find the difference in terms of our agendas. There may be small differences about strategy and tactics, but those get smaller by the day. So I think this is a really good news story, that we have a springboard, we really have a perfect storm, and in fact, we really have no alternative. That is the only way forward. In which we are going to get out of here alive. And it's happening much faster than any of us would have dreamed, for better and for worse. And I think Donald Trump, you know, in an odd and ironic way, Donald Trump is sort of the silver lining that makes us see, as Chris was saying, he is the symptom, he is not the disease, he is the product. Remember, most people who voted for Donald Trump were not voting for him. This was shown by many studies. They weren't for him. They were against what the Democrats have to offer, which tells us more of the neoliberal agenda. And we saw, both by the sabotage of Bernie Sanders, we saw by what happened at the DNC, where the reform agenda was beaten back. The ban on corporate funding was defeated, where Keith Ellison was defeated because Barack Obama created a candidate to oppose him and to push him back. And then, if that wasn't enough, then the California Democratic Party, like 3 weeks ago, also defeated their progressive reform candidate in the one state that really had the best organized progressive movement within the Democratic Party. How much longer are we going to wait? We got 2 feet over the cliff. We are in a free fall. If we get out and we organize in a social movement as well as in a political movement, we can take our future back. We can create an America and a world that works for all of us, that puts people, planet, and peace over profit. We have the power to create that world. If we don't do it, no one will. I hope you will be a part of that fight. Thank you.
Dr. Jill Stein, 2016 Green Party presidential candidate. Margaret Kimberly is next. Her Freedom Writer column appears weekly in Black Agenda Report. She says it's important not to be fooled.
We're living in a time of great contradiction. Trump symbolizes many of those. But the world is in... He's president because of these crises. The crisis of legitimacy, which delegitimized elite consensus, which is why they go on and on about fake news, because people are clearly, for many reasons, not believing it anymore. But the crisis is economic. The capitalist system is under great stress. It provides fewer and fewer benefits to the masses of people. It's on its last legs, but that is also what makes it so dangerous. And it explains everything from the Brexit vote to the heightened imperialist imperative. It explains the whipped-up frenzy of Russophobia and the attacks on a right-wing president by the elites and by the deep state. Ever since Trump took the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and we've been hearing a lot, about the danger of environmental collapse and even mass extinction. But at the same time, I think we need to point out that this Paris Agreement was not everything that we were told that it was. Of course, I don't agree with Trump that climate change is a hoax. I don't think having a green economy is going to hurt the economy or hurt workers. But it's also true that the accord was a ruse by which the rich countries gave the appearance of doing something about climate change when they were not. Just to mention just one problematic aspect of the agreement, it actually permitted the world temperature to rise even more. So here we are, we're trying to escape all the traps and all the contradictions that go along with them. The political trap that we live with here in the United States is this two-party duopoly of the Republicans and the Democrats. And what we have, in essence, is one far-right party and one center-right party. And the system is set up to exclude third parties or to relegate them to irrelevancy or even spoiler status. And I'd like to talk about something else, election integrity, about voter suppression. Hillary Clinton lost key states, I'm sure of it, because of voter suppression. But she has said nothing about, she finally did a couple days ago. She and other Democrats, the Congressional Black Caucus, have said nothing about that. And John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, civil rights icon, I don't know how you get designated that, but he said Trump was not the legitimate president, and when asked why, did he say it was because of voter suppression? No. Did he say it's because of voter ID laws? No. Did he say it's because of the Electoral College? Nope. He said it's because of Russia. And he and the rest of the Congressional Black Caucus don't even talk about black people anymore. So this is where we are now. And that, I believe, makes the case for not apologizing by cutting them loose. And by working together, by running candidates for office, I don't think we really have a choice. We live in a world where 8 billionaires have as much money as half the poor people, something like that. And the climate crisis, which is real and severe, which is going to continue even if the United States stayed in that climate pact. So I say We have to stand our ground and stay the course and keep doing what we've been doing. Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum 2017 Part 1, a panel drawn from a conference titled Resistance, held in New York City June 2nd through June 4th. We heard from Chris Hedges, Medea Benjamin, Dr. Jill Stein, and Margaret Kimberly. Linda Perry, WBAI News, Pacifica Radio, New York. Notes from the Left Forum 2017, Part 3. The conference titled Resistance was held in New York City June 2nd through June 4th, and it looked at questions of power, strategy, and tactics as the resistance to Donald Trump rises. The focus of many panels this year was on moving beyond Trump into an examination of the system which produced him. Part 3 of Notes from the Left Forum is drawn from a panel on resisting NYPD gang policing, as well as a discussion on black and black crime, myth or reality. We'll hear from criminologist and sociologist David Brotherton, Nick Powers with The Independent, and Kazembe Balagan with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. We begin with Dr. David Brotherton, who teaches at the CUNY Graduate Center, the City University of New York's Graduate Center, and at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, as NYPD gang raids in early morning hours have alarmed parents and public housing residents. While new figures show crime in New York City is down, Brotherton says it doesn't matter if crime is up or down as far as resources and policing is concerned. Dr. Brotherton.
There'll always be a demand from the police themselves for more policing. Doesn't matter if crime goes down. If it goes down, we need more police to make sure it doesn't go up. And if it goes up, we need more police to make sure it doesn't, right? So it doesn't matter. But all the time, as they want more and more resources, and by the way, try to figure out what the budget is of the NYPD, I mean, you have to be Sherlock Holmes. I mean, there are so many different budget, right, coming from different sources, from state, government, from drug raids. God knows where a lot of this money goes, by the way. It's like a parallel state, essentially. So you have to understand the continuity of this. And now in a period of, as Alex writes, ultra-militarization of the police, right, where the police doesn't simply get trained anymore by the police. The police constantly interact with every other military force of the state to get its training. And I'll give you one little example of this, which surprised me. The other day, I was in immigration court. I do a lot of court hearings as an expert. I've written books on deportation to stop people getting deported. And I'm in the waiting room, and I'm talking about to the brother of a guy who's being deported, a very sick man. And I'm talking to his brother, and I said, well, how did you, what happened when your brother got picked up? He said, yeah, Dave, it was really amazing. It was like some tactical team came breaking through our house in Washington Heights at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This was an afternoon raid. And they broke in. He said they were like from four units. I said, well, what's all units? He says, well, there was the ICE, and there was the NYPD, and there was the FBI, and there was, he said, I forget what the other one was. I said, well, your brother has no history of drug dealing. He's 42 years of age. He's on disability. He's eaten up with arthritis and psoriasis. He hasn't worked for 3 years. He has no priors. He's never been in prison in his life. He said, yeah, I know. They came in, and I said, well, what happened to your brother? Because I read this in the file. He said, well, this big guy comes in the front with like a big ninja jacket, he said. And he goes up to my brother. My brother's having a cup of coffee in the kitchen, and he smashes him over the head with the butt of his pistol. And I said, well, how many times did he hit him? He said, he hit him 3 times. And he fell to the floor, and we all thought he was dead. I said, your brother? He said, there was blood coming out of his, and he was completely unconscious. And one of the other guys, and there was, I said, how many people? He said, oh, there must have been 25 people in the house. And his mum's a 62-year-old woman. She's on disability as well. She's got type 1 diabetes or whatever it is. So the guy's completely out. This other guy says to him, I think he's dead. You better get the fuck out of here. He said, I don't give a fucking shit. Let him die. And I'm going, what is this? What world are we living in? So as I'm sitting there, I'm listening to this guy, and this guy, the guy's getting deported, has filed charges against the police, and his brother, that's why they've locked him up again. They've come to pick him up because he's got charges against him. So I looked up on the, and I studied these ICE and this shit, and I'm looking up on the, my phone, and I'm looking up for, you know, who's this special team from ICE? It's called Special Response Team, SRT. Look it up. Look it up. They train at Fort Benning, Georgia. And guess who they train with? Navy SEALs. They're trained by Navy SEALs. These guys, they said, and the thing, it said, we only accept 5% of applications. And you get extra money for being in this space. These are the kinds of, this is the culture that produces, basically, these armed thugs of the state. Could easily be Turkey, right? It could easily be Russia. It could easily, what? It happens to be here, right? In this cosmopolitan city of culture, right? City of tolerance, of zero tolerance. Right? And so this is the culture that we, that now this is the norm. This is why these gang raids happen on such a scale. This is why there's money for these gang raids, right? And nobody thinks about the collateral damages and the consequences. It's such a shame that the other two people not here who've seen their children getting put away for 55 years, by the way. 18, 19-year-old children got out of prison for 55 years for conspiracy laws. The second thing I want to say, and I'll finish, because I'm going to take time from the two brothers, is that what goes on here, what creates this culture, which is a major weapon in this culture, right, is the use of what we call the moral panic. Okay? There's a book recently come out, if you checked it out, by Brooke Gladstone. She has this, you know, all a media show and WNYC. And she's sort of focusing on the moral panic. The moral panic concept, the moral panic, comes out of criminology back in the 60s. Comes out of England, where I'm from, where we wrote about mods and rockers, right? Or later skinheads or drug takers, you know, the whole drugs war and how you build up. You have to build up this whole pantomime, really, around the social problem in order not to address the social problem. You need this orchestration of people's fears, people's anxieties, in order to stampede them in a certain direction, that the othering of these people, the dehumanization of these people, right? The character assassination of these people is not only acceptable, it's necessary. The dangerous classes. And so what we live in now is a permanent moral panic. Trump is the end result, is the quintessential exemplar of the perpetrator of the moral panic. He is there due to moral panicking, you see. And he can't let it go. That's why he tweets all the time. You see, he's addicted to the moral panic. Right? He has moral panicitis. And so we live in this period of the moral panic. And so for us, you know, comrades and people in the resistance, we need an analysis that basically exposes how these moral panics work and how the media plays into the moral panic, sometimes willingly and sometimes completely unconsciously, because it's news. Who gives a shit? I've got to make the money, right? I've got to cover the story. But you are leading this. You are creating the cultural groundwork for this to take place. And the final point I want to make is this. They're not just doing gang raids. This is what the interesting thing is, right? Cyrus Vance has a whole bunch of prosecutors who work under him, right, to oversee the charges, right? They're like, you know, they're like the fray corps of the court, right? Conspiracy laws, send your kids away, who gives a shit? They deserve it. At the same time, Cyrus Vance has billions of dollars in his account from the banks who paid fines in order for none of the bastards to go to prison. Billions. 2.5 billion, whatever it is, I forget what the number is. Right? He didn't know what to do with all that money. So he gave it to some of us at CUNY, at the Center for the Study of Government, to dish out. To whom? To certain areas, a hotspot, they're called hotspot areas in New York, where these gang raids are happening, to fund non-profits, right, in prevention of violence. $65 million he just gave out. in February to about 22 nonprofits. So at the same time, listen, check this out. At the same time, this is how it works, right? Capitalism, right? The big guys, the real gangsters, the banksters, don't go to prison, but they get out of jail card by paying it off, blood money, our blood. That money comes to the state or the city. The city doesn't know what to do with it, so we throw it around the violence. They're probably putting some money in the NYPD because they always need more money. And it all goes on at the same time. So we get the right hand of the state, the highly coercive hand of the state, right, this militarized hand of the state, and at the same time as we have this pastoral hand of the state, the so-called nurturing, the preventive, the more rational, all happening simultaneously. Right? And that's what happens. That's what capitalism needs. What the thing is obviously what's going more and more is the right hand of the state, more and more coerciveness, but it can't be just coercive because otherwise we can't call ourselves a democracy. So we stick in a little bit of the pastoral hand. But it all works simultaneously. And it's in that context that these gang raids are taking place. Thanks very much.
Sociologist and criminologist Dr. David Brotherton. And you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 3, drawn from a panel on resisting NYPD gang policing, as well as a discussion on black-on-black crime, myth or reality. Here's former New York City Mayor and Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani back in July on Face the Nation.
There's too much violence in the black community. So a black will die 1% or less at the hands of the police and 99% at the hands of a civilian, most often another black. So if you want to protect black lives, then you got to protect black lives not just against police, which happens rarely, although with tremendous attention, and which happens every 14 hours in Chicago, every 14 hours, and we never hear from Black Lives Matter. Well, so if you want to deal, with this on the black side, you've got to teach your children to be respectful to the police, and you've got to teach your children that the real danger to them is not the police. The real danger to them, 99 out of 100 times, 9,900 out of 1,000 times, are other black kids who are going to kill them. That's the way they're going to die.
So, Mr. Mayor... Now,
Giuliani's comments on black-on-black crime was seen as a racist conservative attack to reinforce mass incarceration by many, including our next speaker, poet, journalist, and professor Nick Powers with The Independent.
The image of Giuliani on TV was seared into my brain when he said, we are, in a sense, kind of rescuing black people from black people. He said, black people kill more black people than white cops ever could. I'm paraphrasing, but essentially that's what he said. And when he said that, he was not only justifying mass incarceration for a mass audience, not only in a sense bolstering Donald Trump's election campaign, but he also was overlapping a prior conversation that was actually happening within the black community itself. I remember when I first heard the phrase black on black crime. It was in the 90s. And it did not come from outside the community. It came from inside the community. There was a very real panic about what was happening in our families, in our streets, in our neighborhoods. And because it was coming from within the community, it didn't have the sense of selling out, betraying each other. It was a very serious accounting. How can we repair the damage that has been done by racism, by poverty, by mass incarceration onto our families and our neighborhoods? But when this language has been kept inside the community because there was always this fear that if black anxiety over crime seeped outside of the family, outside of the circle, it would be vacuumed up by racial conservatives and be used as an excuse to reinforce state oppression of black communities. Ultimately, it is a very touchy, it is an emotionally vulnerable thing to talk about, because from the outside, it looks like you're just talking about, oh, Latino criminals, black criminals, gangbangers. But for us, that is my cousin. For us, that is my brother, that's my niece, that's my sister, that's my uncle who just came back from the joint, that's my mom, that's my dad. In other words, there is a twin conflict because you are dealing with actual family members, not abstract numbers and not caricatures on a TV. And it is that conflict within the soul of how do you deal with people who have been deeply wounded by a life in crime. And at the same time, you can't stop loving them. They don't stop loving you, but you still have somehow to pick up the scars and tie those scars back into the web of love, back into the web of community. How do you do that? All right, finally, that there is a question about, well, what are some of the causes about this? And the hardest thing to break in terms of the cause for quote-unquote black-on-black crime. Because people can say, doesn't every community that is struck by poverty resort to some level to crime? Is it more of a class thing? Hold on. Isn't it more of a class thing? And the reason that thing just kind of bothered me. And one of the reasons is in my neighborhood, I live in Bed-Stuy, right off of the corner of Nostrand in Quincy. I would say there's 2 to 3 shootings on my block at least every summer. Summer is the hot season, a lot of shootings. I don't know why not so much in winter. Maybe the guns freeze up. Maybe they're cheap guns. I don't know. A lot of shootings in the summer. A good friend of mine who I've known for years, there was a young man running and trying to shoot someone else. He obviously didn't get trained. He was just shooting wildly. He shot my friend 4 times. Luckily, he missed all the major arteries. I remember when I was walking to a bar, the Voodoo bar down the street, my friend Frankie waved me over. He was sitting in the truck, and he actually rolled up his sleeves, and he rolled up his pant leg, and he showed me the crust where the bullets had passed through and where the scab was. So I was deeply shaken. This is a friend of mine who I care for deeply. He's invited me to his house. He's teaching me guitar, and he was just millimeters away from having his blood spill out on the ground. Last story, I was in Oakland. I got a phone call from a friend of mine. She's like, you know, someone got shot on your block. And I was like, ah, not again. And when I came back to New York, I saw that there was a small candle for a young 19-year-old girl named Beverly Turner who had gotten shot in the back 6 times, literally right down the block. And when I asked what had happened to one of my neighbors, he said, some dyke got shot because she was with some other guy. And I was just like, Now, this was at the height of Black Lives Matter. So, which means that I'm out there protesting on the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm out there protesting in the street. But I am coming home to incredible amounts of violence in my neighborhood. And I couldn't let go of that contradiction. So this is the final thesis that I'm going to leave you. Is it just class? We all know that there's an incredible amount of internalized racism that we all have. Racism it's a toxic that is in the water that we all drink. And we also know that those of us, people of color, also have internalized racism too. Is it possible that on top of the poverty, on top of the weird American fetish with guns, which means that there's more guns in this country than there are people, is it possible that a certain internalized racism makes it easier for those of us of color to pull the trigger on other people of color? Because we've all drank the water. We all have the toxic inside of us. And my fear is that that part of black-on-black crime has only been indirectly addressed. Malcolm X talked about it when he says, who taught you how to hate your skin? Who taught you how to hate your hair, right? All along, there has been a critique by black revolutionaries of the effects of internalized racism. We see it in the fetishizing of light-skinned people, quote-unquote good hair. We see it in the way that we throw nigger around like a knife out of our mouths, slashing each other. So yeah, sometimes it's said in love, but we also know that on the other side of that love is a razor. So I just want to ask that that's a possibility, and to raise that as a conceptual intervention and to say, can that be included as a way of trying to purge ourselves of this idea of black-on-black crime. So with that, I'd like to actually give it to the brother Kazembe. And Kazembe, if you want to come up.
Nick Powers, poet, journalist with The Independent, and English professor at SUNY, the State University of New York. And you're listening to part three of Notes from the Left Forum, a conference which took place in New York City from June 2nd through June 4th, 2017. Speakers in this program are from a panel out of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. Next up is Kazembe Balogun with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. He was raised in the projects in Harlem, near where Charlie Parker used to play concerts for the Communist League. He grew up in the 80s in the height of the crack epidemic, where traditional Southern communities were transported into the North. Kazembe says what racism does is it cuts society in two in an attack on black political power in New York City.
I think that we have to really go deeper a little bit more in terms of like what was going on in the 1960s, 1970s, where a lot of this stuff was started. And, you know, some of the work of like people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who came out with a report around benign neglect, that was also that they basically said that the issues around the black community were on the black people themselves, which was coming out of the radical revolutionary work of the 1960s, 1970s, the Black Power Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Panther Parties. Connected to that, too, is also this issue around planned shrinkage, the cutting of services in the 1970s, which really damaged our ability to even survive, even have housing. So my question is that, you know, in New York City right now, you know, me having my experience growing up in projects, we have a broken windows policy, but ain't nobody fixing no broken windows. You know? Like, the windows stay broken in the projects.
Supposedly it ended.
Yeah, it supposedly ended, but no. You know, and so, like, these gang raids are also a reflection of that. The second part I want to bring up, too, is the fact that, like, how we kind of distance ourselves from our own brothers and sisters. For me, it's like, when you talk about gang raids and taking people out for 20, 30, 40 years, this is a form of displacement, an uprooting of people, uprooting of whole communities. And so that you don't see the people who really protect you anymore. You know, and these are very complicated situations, right? It's like everyone, like the same way that, you know, I'm sure people who, you know, who are drone operators go home to their families, you know what I'm saying? People who may be involved in the game are people who care about the community. They're the people who protect us. They're the people who talk to us. They're the people who tell you what's going on. And so when you take them out, you're taking out whole entire blocks of generations. The other thing I really want to talk about is, like, why are we talking about the projects now? You know what I'm saying? And, like, this is a very, I think this is very important because the one word that we have to really bring up is displacement and gentrification. Back when I was growing up in the 1980s and 1990s, you had to go downtown to see that, you know what I'm saying, below 110th Street, you know what I'm saying? Now there's a recolonization of Harlem, you know, in which you're seeing this wealth coming out into the projects. Right across the street from the projects, you have wealthy stores, you know, and Starbucks. And the projects and the housing authorities standing on some of the most valuable land in the city. So part of that is also talking about displacement. And to me, this is also a political question because then what you're talking about, too, is the attack against black political power throughout the city, right, and black and brown political power. And you see that as not so much as in terms of the relationship of, like, the stores that are there and everything else, because if you talk about the 1990s, then you have to connect that to the whole entire opening up of the free trade zones and the empowerment zones that were happening in Harlem and Upper Manhattan that were going on and a lot of that stuff. But also at the same time, the political disempowerment of these communities, the redistricting, the gerrymandering that was happening at the exact same time, you know? And the very fact that, you know, we had someone like Charles Rangel who finally was on the House committee. My dad, let me tell you, my dad only voted for two people in his whole entire life. Adam Clayton Powell, who you saw speak, you know, when he first got into Harlem, my dad, imagine this, my dad got out of a subway out of Harlem. He saw two people the first day he got to Harlem, Malcolm X and Adam Clayton Powell. And he was like, all right, you know, and then Charles Rangel. And then when Charles Rangel become the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, then he got suspended without any political backup, even from the new black political establishment. So what does that mean in terms of our own power in our communities? You know, so this is stuff that we have to do in terms of being redistricted and being pushed around. So I'm saying that to say is that part of this thing around the gang raids is that I think that everyone here agrees to this to a certain extent, that we really need to come to each other and actually be able to see each other. And that's why I think this work is so innovative, because it's taking the least of us, the people that were considered, quote unquote, the most dangerous, and actually forced them up as the first, right? As political subjects, as people that we need to defend. Because the thing about the whole type thing about the project is the reason that they can get away with it is because we're not seen as citizens. You know what I'm saying? Our citizenship was taken away from us. The same way that, you know, that happened right during New Orleans, you know, when people were evacuated and not allowed to come back, you know. So it's a matter of political citizenship that we have to engage in, you know, overcoming social alienation and political power. And the last thing I want to say is that I really, you know, I want to take on Nick's challenge in terms of how do we see black-on-black crime. My own personal opinion, my own political opinion for what I've seen is that black-on-black crime is something that folks announce as an excuse to attack black people. You know, that being said, you know what I'm saying? Because I'm very careful in terms of what my enemy says and what the people say. So when Donald Trump says that, you know, I'm gonna deal with black-on-black crime, I'm gonna send the National Guard to Chicago, that's something to be worried about. You know, when we have this dude, Ben Carson, as a head of HUD, and he says poverty is a state of mind, you know, and that, you know, we came here as immigrants, you know, black folks, then that's something I worry about. But I also think that the other part of it, too, is that I think that we really do need to reengage and rebuild in terms of black civil society and black community and retake public space. You know, and we really need to have things like you talk about a gang raid. We need to have like mass embodiment of indigenous communities, and it has to be many different types of people on the streets taking up space. You know what I'm saying? We need a reaffirmation of community. We need a reaffirmation of the public space. We need to take that public space and step out. You know, one of the best things I saw this week was a YouTube video, was that a group of folks from Queens, in Lawton, I think it was, you know, there was an ICE raid against their neighbors. The whole community came out, was like, what are you doing? Let them go. That's our brother. You know what I'm saying? That was something that was really powerful to me in terms of how we can see ourselves. The last thing I would say is that we also have to really reclaim the projects as our own. There's a lot of laws that are going on right now. I think one of the sisters who was actually involved in the Bronx gang raid right now is trying to kick her out. Yep. You know what I'm saying? If you're convicted of a felony, family members convicted of a felony, you're gonna be permanently kicked out of housing, which means in New York City, that means death. That means that you'd be completely displaced from New York City. You know? So I think that's something on a very basic federal level, city level, that we have to challenge those laws that allow folks that really challenge that law.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 3, with Professors David Brotherton and Nick Powers, and with Kazembe Balagan from a panel called Resisting NYPD Gang Policing, with a discussion on black-on-black crime, myth or reality. You can find out more about the Left Forum by going to leftforum.org. The conference was held in New York City from June 2nd through June 4th at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Linda Perry, WBAI News, Pacifica Radio, New York.